Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. The show wouldn't exist without you. I'm attempting to do a few things here on this show. And anybody who's a return viewer may remember some of these themes, but I feel it is important to reiterate my purpose for myself and just to make it very clear. I want to push love on the show, and I want to push a very particular form of it. I see love as unconditional, and I think that you're born with it. I think that every speck of life is imbibed in love. I think for me, if there's any sense of God or divinity, it is in how I appreciate and see this unconscious, undefined love. I see a movement forward towards something, some entropy or change, consistent change, constant change. And I see this formulative energy as love, if that makes any sense at all. And I want people to have a creative way to seek meaning in their lives. And the things that I seek and what I look into and I find important may be unimportant and may be drastically different for you and the path that you choose for yourself. I would hope that it would be a more sensitive, individual, artistic expression for each person to go find their own meaning and appreciation towards life. And I see this as forming a relationship with life in a way. And you may disagree with me. I am primarily interested in religious texts and philosophical texts, both of Western and Eastern origin. The West and the East have very different backgrounds, but I think all acts of looking into the human psyche are important. And that's what I do, because I have always found it confusing learning how to see myself and how I interact with others. And so the psychology of humans and how other people have thought about themselves and their own ways towards life has always been quite revealing to me in my own journey, if that makes any sense. But I don't have any attachments to any of the world's religions, especially of any organized form. And I sort of feel that I'm picking whatever I want from any of the various symbolized ways of seeing life. A long time ago on the show, and I don't even know what episode, I told a parable. And with as many episodes as I have now published, and with a lot of my ideas probably buried, depending on how far you want to look into my show, I do encourage you to look back, especially towards the beginning. I picked a lot of more historical context, and I like to do more research, which I don't really do much anymore. And I may do that eventually. I may do a researched episode in the future again. But I do feel that there's a lot of other things that I've bounced around. And so I do encourage you to go look backwards into the ledger of the Gingerbread Man. One of the favorite stories that I've told, I call the, I guess I don't really have any firm names on any of my shit. Okay, I guess I'll name it after I tell it, attemptedly. So imagine yourself walking into a vast valley of tremendous proportions, and you can build it however you wish in your head. But filled within this space are a diverse array of plant life, vegetative is how I always see it, like, but a bunch of different types of plants, like huge, unearthly, gigantic trees and small bushes and little flowers and grasses and just a sheer abundance of just growing life. And you start to walk into this area and you carry with you a basket. And you start looking around, and on each of the plants, you notice that there are healthier parts and segments of the plants that have fallen off or seem to be dying, because with the growing nature of plant life requires pruning. And with growth comes that excess, you see. And you notice these things, but the ripe fruits, the ones that aren't too firm or too ripened, they are drawn to your eye, and you feel inclined to pick these pieces of the plants that you find appealing. And you continue walking through your garden of beliefs, say. And further in, you begin to notice other proprietors and other benefactors of this beautiful Eden. And you notice that some of the people become rather attached to plants of one type or another. And some even build fences around their chosen plant, and with loud blow horns and speakers yell and proselytize and say that all other plants are fictional and illusionary, and the only real plant in the entire valley is their own plant, which can make it difficult to approach these things. And you become concerned as some people become sick as they begin to eat the rotten fruit and the parts of the tree that no longer describe or are useful. And it saddens you that they don't have the opportunity to see the millions and myriad of other plants that are procuring fresh fruit everywhere around you. So you walk and walk and continue to pick ripened fruit and try your best not to cause fights or to be led into a structure where you no longer can smell the fresh scents and see the beautiful flowers around you. And do you ever fill your basket, or do one day do you just sit down and choose to plant a seed? So that's kind of how I see the world around us. Ram Dass said that there's a mountain, and I've said this one plenty of times, but there's a mountain that everybody's climbing up or walking around in circles or straight up through cliff faces or on nice paths that are well trodden. And once we get to the top at the peak, we all see the same thing. A term, I think, also enshrined by omnism. One is all. I see truth, and I don't know if it's even flavored by my own beliefs becoming stronger, where I start to see my own beliefs in everything that I look at or pick up, and then I'm flavoring it with my own subjective opinion, which is also possible. But that's why I like to have interviews as often as possible too. Here on the show, I hope to have some new interviews soon, maybe even next week. It's important to talk to others and to challenge yourself. And I often read things that I don't agree with. I like to read parenting books a lot to help with my parenting of my son. And that's also a theme I talk about here on the show, is how we can help our kids and try to parent better. But I've read quite a few parenting books that I stiffly disagree with, you see. So it's good to not just stick with the fresh fruit at all times. It's very good to study and see why the rotten fruit is rotten. And also to help clean it up, maybe. I don't know, mixing metaphors, getting very murky. That's what I like to do. So, this week I have been thinking a lot about a lot of different ideas. I started a new author named Petri Domanovich Uspensky, also shortened to P.D. Uspensky. I think he was Russian, or maybe from one of those occupied countries at that time period. He did most of his writings in the early 1900s, which I find a highly endearing moment of history and thought. But he, from a very Western vantage point, depicted how we as humans have no firm ability to do things. He had a very deterministic philosophy, whereas determinism is where everything's determined, everything is always what it is be, and we are simply mechanistic and reacting to outside stimuli. So I don't know how much I believe in that. I think that free will certainly has some stance in this play. I mean, there's no way to say it's any one or the other. Yet his transient form of human consciousness, he even tried to say that consciousness itself is not a reality or a thing. We don't have any firm conscious being either. This system of I's and me's that I've liked to spoken about on the show. He basically drew a picture in his book. It was a graph with a bunch of squares outlaid, just squares and squares, kind of like a multiplication table. But inside all of the squares is just an I. And every moment we are a new I, and certain I's become attached together because we learned conditioned responses and reactions to certain external stimuli. But the attachment and idea that I am this I right now is purely illusionary. And it's the grand scope of memory and patterns as certain eyes linger with other eyes friendly. Say you have a cyclical way of approaching a situation the same over and over again. For instance, Saturday mornings I like to read, you know, and it's calm, and I try to do it before my son wakes up. However, when my son disturbs what I like to be doing, which is reading, I become aggravated. So I'm attached to this sense of I'm comfortable right now. This is an eye that I've crafted and I could get to whenever I pick up the external stimuli, which is my book, and I sit in a calm space and I can craft the sense of momentary being, you see. But then attached to that is annoyance when I get bothered. And so as soon as my son starts talking or making noises, and then I have a new momentary eye that's bothered and can't read, and whereas just 30 seconds before I could have been comfortably reading, now I'm aggravated and I can't think straight, so I can't even focus. These are two very separate momentary beings, but they're closely attached together, and I've seen them hang out a lot. They're quite friendly. So we can have this scope of who we think we are dependent upon momentary situations, and I do think that that is definitely true and prevalent. Yet, I don't want to be unconscious to my actions and my abilities. And I'm firmly aware that there's a lot of things that I'm very unconscious about. There's a lot of things that I do not know about myself. And I would hazard to say that there are plenty that you do not know about yourself, that is. There's a huge ocean of non-existence, which non-existence is very real. It's a very real being that is birthing all the feelings and moments from within based upon how what we think is external and how we react to ourselves through our external environment. But we can become unconscious of our actions too. It's very easy to go on autopilot because we're tired or stressed, and we can just go through the motions. For instance, I did get bothered this morning. I did get aggravated. And I reacted in traditional fashion like a bastard, not a very good father. Yet, I looked at the moment, and as the mushroom taught me several times throughout my life, every moment is very transient, and with a couple breaths, you can get to the next one quite frequently. And that's the trick. It's like surfing. Even when we get to a situation that is tense, a lot of times I have very much wanted to not be where I am. Very much so. In school, in boring classes that I decided I didn't want to be in, I remember being so physically and mentally uncomfortable because I wanted to be anywhere else. You see? But that intense desire to not wanting to be is the root of some of what suffering is in humanity. And so the conscious approach to this, which it comes up all the time in my adulthood when I'm working, and I've found it comes, I think, when my blood sugar drops around halfway through my shift is where I really, really would like to not be at work. But I catch it really quickly, and it's like a breath. And then even noticing that desire to not wanting to be at that moment will pass quickly. And I think the unconscious approach is identifying with it, and then it lingers, and it crafts a home, and then you have this pregnant pause of a space of not wanting to be. The trick to living in a conscious moment longer and longer is to try to just be in it, even if it feels uncomfortable. Now, it's not always possible to be comfortable. You see. A really good meditative practice is mindful breathing, which is a lot harder than it sounds. Try to watch your breath and see how quickly you forget to watch your breath. And I know it sounds like a very simple act, and it is. It's breathing. We do it non-conditionally without focusing on it. There's a word for that. I can't think of it right now. But breathing takes care of itself. And so just watching it sounds like it would be an easy thing. But when you first start the practice, you can watch your breath for maybe 5 or 6 breaths, and then all of a sudden, you're drawn into the world of things and the world of thinking, and then all of a sudden, you're thinking about something, and you're not watching your breath anymore. P.D. Uspensky, he said something, and I think I could focus on myself a lot longer. Anyways, he said that if you sit down in a quiet room and just focus on your being and notice where you are and just try to avoid any other thoughts but your physical space and where you're sitting and who you are, you can do it for about 2 minutes at a time. I think I could do it longer because I've spent some time meditating, but I might be maybe a little bit overestimating myself. if you count all the little micro thoughts that sneak in, you know. So when an intense desire to not want to be where you are comes in, I have been just throwing myself into it. And in that moment, like PD, even if I'm flipping eggs, I intensely watch every step of the motion of flipping the egg. I read a really good metaphor, I think, probably from Alan Watts. Yeah, where he was talking about how the ancient Chinese sages and elders would depict how the masters, the craftsmen, the soldiers, whoever is an expert in what they do, how their movements would be heavy. Whereas when I'm not masterful, I am spinning and frantic, and my movements aren't heavy. So I try to make my movements heavy, and I throw myself into that moment, and I'm shocked by how quickly I don't care if I'm not there anymore. I don't know if that makes any sense. But anyhow, there's a lot of situations in life that are comfortable. Like learning new things. Learning new physical skills and hopefully having fun while doing it. I had a lot of fun learning how to drive my car. I've had a lot of fun skating. And both require intense presence. But intense presence without trying to control it. When we want to not be somewhere, it is out of a sense of control, I believe. We're trying to exert control. And the reasoning for exerting control is to make ourselves feel happy or placid or more comfortable. But the more control we exert over our outside world, the less it is possible to be presently minded and just being in it. Because being in it, you have to be an active participant. You cannot watch the waves hit the shore and think about yourself watching the waves hit the shore at the same time. Honestly, we can have a lot of things going at one time, but we can only focus at one at a time. It's a lot simpler. It's a lot less distracting and taxing if we can do that. Well, I hope some of my rambling is relatable, and I hope that some of it's helpful in some way, shape, or form. Your input is very valuable. I'm very curious to know what you are thinking about. I want to know about what moments in your life you don't want to be in. Are you bored of driving to work? Are you sick of working? Is it hard for you to play with your kids? Do you not like your time off from work? Is it hard to find rest? I'd love to know the things in your life that are making it a struggle to just be in them. You can email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com, and I know that's long, but there's a hyperlink in the show notes wherever you're watching this show. Also, my show's available anywhere else, so I hope that you can help us make this a community effort, and I'd like to get your ideas into this. Even if you'd like to possibly be interviewed over a Skype call or something of the sort. But I would really like to have a discourse with you. So just keep that in mind. So before we get off to Odin, I'm going to go grab a couple of my books and we can do some quotations and discuss the words of others briefly. If you don't want to do that, you can skip to the end and listen to Odin. I highly encourage you to listen to Little Man's ideas. He's very wise. He's very worldly. Thank you. Thank you for being you. Thank you for waking up this morning. And I thank your heart and your lungs for beating and breathing for you. And I'm so grateful that we're in this beautiful world that exists with us in it. I love it. All right. Firstly, I'm going to be reading from some of the writings of Aleister Crowley. Crowley has a very negative reputation, and he did do a lot of fucked up shit. But he compiled a very interesting philosophy for himself, and he's from that peculiar time period of the late 1800s and early 1900s that I find highly compelling. This is from his Book of Magic, Chapter 6, which is the wand, which I'm not quite sure if it is purely metaphor, if he was very serious about his symbolic meanings, but I found this kind of interesting, and I'm just going to read a page to you as a sample. This is called The Wand. The magical will is in its essence twofold, for it presupposes a beginning and an end. To will to be a thing is to admit that you are not that thing. Hence, to will anything but the supreme thing is to wander still further from it. Any will but that to give up the self to the beloved is black magic. Yet this surrender is so simple an act that to our complex minds it is the most difficult of all acts, and hence training is necessary. Further, the self surrendered must not be less than the all self. One must not come before the altar of the Most High with an impure or an imperfect offering. As it is written in Liber LXV, I don't know that number right now, to await thee is the end, not the beginning. This training may lead through all sorts of complications, varying according to the nature of the student, and hence it may be necessary for him at any moment to will all sorts of things which to others might seem unconnected with the goal. Thus it is not a priori obvious why a billiard player should need a file. Since then, we may want anything. Let us see to it that our will is strong enough to obtain anything we want without loss of time. It is therefore necessary to develop the will to its highest point, even though the last task but one is total surrender of this will. Partial surrender of an imperfect will is of no account in magic. The will being a lever, a fulcrum is necessary. This fulcrum is the main aspiration of the student to attain. All wills which are not dependent upon this principal will are so many leakages. They are like the fat to the athlete. The majority of the people in this world are ataxic. They cannot coordinate their mental muscles to make a purposed movement. They have no real will, only a set of wishes, many of which contradict the others. The victim wobbles from one to the other, and it is no less wobbling because the movements may occasionally be very violent. And at the end of life, the movements cancel each other out. Nothing has been achieved, except for the one thing of which the victim is not conscious, the destruction of his own character. The confirming of his indecision, such an one is torn limb from limb by Chorin's own. So I see echoes of, I don't know if I'm just the only one who sees it, but I think he's talking about unconscious thinking as not having will, and I believe this will can be practiced, and I think that will doesn't have to be completely hedonistic either. You can throw yourself into wanting to make the world better, but that takes practiced attention as well and willpower. You know what I mean? I think he was very selfish, Mr. Crowley, that is. And so I think you can see bits of that in his writing as well. And I just want you to remember that you can get anything out of anything. You know, there is always going to be a diamond in the dust. All right, here you go. This is from P.D. Uspensky's first lecture. I'm just going to read a little sample to you. Man is a machine, but a very peculiar machine. He is a machine which, in right circumstances, and with right treatment, can know that he is a machine. And having fully realized this, he may find the ways to cease to be a machine. First of all, what man must know is that he is not one, he is many. He has not one permanent and unchangeable I or ego. He is always different. One moment, he is one. Another moment, he is another. The third moment, he is a third. And so on, almost without an end. The illusion of unity or oneness is created in man first by the sensation of one physical body, by his name, which in normal cases always remains the same, and third, by a number of mechanical habits which are implanted in him by education or acquired by imitation. Having always the same physical sensation, hearing always the same name and noticing in himself the same habits and inclinations he had before, he believes himself to always be the same. In reality, there is no oneness in man, and there is no controlling center, no permanent I or ego. Every thought, every feeling, every sensation, every desire, every like, and every dislike is an I. These I's are not connected and are not coordinated in any way. Each of them depends on the change in external circumstances and on the change of impression. Some of them mechanically follow some other, and some appear always accompanied by others. But there is no order and no system in that. There are certain groups of eyes which are naturally connected. We will speak about these groups later. Now we must try to understand that there are groups of eyes connected only by accidental associations, accidental memories, or quite imaginary similarities. Each of these eyes represent at any given moment a very small part of our brain, mind, or intelligence. But each of them means itself to represent the whole. When man says I, it sounds as if he meant the whole of himself, but really, even when he himself thinks that he means it, it is only a passing thought, a passing mood, or a passing desire. In any hour's time, he may completely forget it, and with the same conviction express an opposite opinion, opposite view, opposite interests. The worst of it is that man does not remember it. In most cases, he believes in the last I which expressed itself, as long as it lasts. That is, as long as another I, sometimes quite unconnected with the preceding one, does not express its opinion or its desire louder than the first. I find him highly compelling. So, that's my show, guys. Thank you again. I'm gonna go grab a little man.
Hello, people. This is the Asko and the Gingerbread Man. I hope your week was good about school and kids. So, we're doing good.
I have hiccups now.
Yeah, my dad has hiccups.
I don't know why I just developed hiccups over the last 30 seconds. Oh.
I think my dad's about to get really mad since it's because of his hiccups.
I'm not mad.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. You're going to be mad after this hiccups. You're going to be like, ah!
Can you tell me a story?
Oh, yeah. So, I got Darth Vader toys. We got, what kind of toys we got? So, basically, I bought the Mandalorian and Darth Vader.
With your own money?
Yeah, Dirk Vader comes with a weapon, but the Mandalorian already had a weapon in his hand.
Do you want to tell people how you get money?
By killing myself.
No, what? That's awful.
That's kidding.
That's an awful thing to say.
So, every day we servants. So, my servants, when it's the end of the week, I get money.
Oh. Why do you get a deservance?
Because I'm a wife, my dad loves me, and he loves me.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I love you.
Well, I love Daddy the most.
I love you more.
I love you more.
I love you 1 million.
Love you a million.
All right. You ready? Yeah. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.